Our final case for argument today is Good versus Good, which is A24-1816. And we have just one attorney arguing. The respondent is a self-represented litigant in this case. So counsel for appellant, you will just have the 15 minutes for your argument. Feel free to get settled in. I know they were taking their a minute to gather their things, so you feel free to get settled in. But when you are ready, the podium is adjustable. It's sort of center underneath, and you feel free to adjust it to your height. And before you begin your argument, if you'd please state your name and who you are. But again, take your time getting settled, and you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Tiffany Walter, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Anthony Good. Now, this case stems from a marriage dissolution. The parties were divorced pursuant to a court order from October 30th, 2015. On July 25th, 2024, the appellant filed a motion in district court requesting a modification of parenting time and child support. Parties have two children, Chase and Olivia. When appellant's motion was filed, the party's oldest son, Chase, had been living with him on an equal parenting time basis for approximately 1 year. Now, in order to essentially mesh the children's schedules, because the two children were on extremely opposite schedules, as well as modify his child support in order to take into account the fact that Chase had been living with him on an equal parenting time basis, appellant was required to file his motion. Appellant was paying child support based on having Chase in his care for 142 overnights, when in actuality he was exercising the 182.5 overnights. In Minnesota, the child support rules have a parenting time expense adjustment where we adjust the amount of child support that each parent pays pursuant to the amount of parenting time that they are exercising. However, it's not the parenting time that is actually being exercised. It is the parenting time that is pursuant to the actual court order. Now, this court in 2022 issued a pretty substantial precedential decision in the Nelson case, which talked, you know, very in-depth about that concept, that we can't just say, okay, well, one parent isn't exercising their parenting time or one parent is exercising more parenting time, so let's modify the support. So what was really integral to this motion that was filed by appellant was the fact that parenting time needed to be modified. Now, modification of parenting time, of course, is governed by 518.175, which says that we can modify parenting time if it's in the best interests of the children. The court, obviously, in 518.17, we have a whole list of different best interest factors. Now, in the Hansen versus Todenum case, this court kind of made a distinction between what are substantial modifications of parenting time versus what we would consider insubstantial modifications of parenting time. In the Hansen versus Todenum case, the court discusses that when we have substantial modifications of parenting time, we require an evidentiary hearing, as well as the court has to make very particularized findings regarding all of the different best interest factors.
Can I ask, has the modification as to Chase, is that issue now moot since he's turned 18?
It's not moot because it affects the child support, the child support, right? So if this court had gone back and followed the proper rules, right, and modified Chase's parenting time, that would have entitled appellant to a modification in his child support. The child support still can be modified retroactively because my client had a motion pending in July of 2024. So essentially what we would be doing is the court would need to go back, apply the proper standards regarding Chase, decide whether or not parenting time should have been modified, and then modify that child support going, you know, from, I guess, August 1 of 2024 until now, the time that Chase emancipated. So it technically, you know, it's not moot because it affects the child support calculation. Now, as I was saying, in the Hansen versus Totem case, we have the substantial modifications and we have the insubstantial modifications. In this case, I believe that we have an insubstantial modification of parenting time. Good in his affidavit discussed that he was not seeking to modify any sort of primary residence. His home is mere 12 miles away from where the kids go to high school. They go to Wayzata High School. He lives in Maple Plain. It's just a couple of cities down the road. There was no discussion in removing them from any sports, any activities, you know, any schools, anything like that. It was an insubstantial modification that would allow him an additional overnight on the weeks that he had the children. So in the Hansen versus Totem case, the Court of Appeals said that in that situation, the district court does not have to go through every single best interest factor and make findings regarding that, but the court does have to provide some sort of findings that would support its position that the decision is in the best interest of the children. There has to be some sort of analysis of whatever best interest factors would be relevant to this situation. Now, the court's order in this instance, as it discusses Chase, is simply one paragraph. One paragraph that says, well, Chase is 17, he's going to do whatever he wants, and so the court's not going to modify his parenting time.
Did father analyze the best interest factors before the district court?
Father provided an affidavit which discussed several of the... It doesn't specifically say this is factor one and here is how I have analyzed it. But in Father's affidavit touches on pretty much all of the best interest factors.
But there's no analysis that was provided to the district court. They weren't listed out, and there was an argument of this factor applies because of these particular facts. These factors are not applicable here, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And case law states that it is the parent's burden to establish that modification is in the best interest of the child.
Correct.
So if no arguments were made to the district court, how can the district court be faulted for not discussing the best interest factors when father did not discuss any of the best interest factors and provide that analysis for the court?
Well, father provided all of the information for the court to do the analysis, right? Father discusses, the child's welfare, the relationship between him and the children, the benefits to maximizing his parenting time. The affidavit doesn't specifically, like I said, lay out here is factor one and here is how this applies.
But that's what affidavits do. The district court needs some type of argument to show and explain why the particular facts laid out in the affidavit meet the best interest factors and why ultimately the best interest factors support a modification.
I would disagree with that. The party needs to give the court the information, and then the court needs to apply the law to the information that it's been given.
The court can't do a party's job for them. I mean, case law is pretty clear that the burden is on the party to establish why the best interest factors support a modification. I mean, kind of that link that needs to that's why those arguments need to be presented to the court.
Mm-hmm. So interestingly, in anticipation of that argument, Your Honor, I did go on the court's website and look to see what the forms are that a pro se party would use in order to make an argument to the court for modifying parenting time. And in the pro se forms, there's a paragraph that the person fills out saying, why do you think it's in the best interest for the children to, parenting time to change? And so then the pro se party just puts in a paragraph as to what information they think applies. There's not, in those pro se forms, there is not factor one, tell the court this, factor two, tell the court that, factor three, tell the court that. It's just not in the forms that somebody who didn't have an attorney would fill out. So the party's only requirement is to give the court the information to make the decision based on the statute. I don't see any sort of case law or any sort of, anything in the statute that says you have to tell the court in your affidavit specifically which factors apply and why they apply.
But father was represented below here, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, relying on the pro se forms, I don't think gets you there, because we hold the pro se parties to the same standards, but we also give them
right.
a little bit of leeway. Whereas here, as a represented party or party with representation, knows that that's father's burden to meet. So a more detailed analysis of best interest seems like it should have been done.
Hindsight, I guess, is 2020, Your Honor. But like I say, all of the information was in the affidavit. Maybe it wasn't entirely spelled out. Here is factor one. Here is the information. But the information was provided in the affidavit.
So in terms of the court's best interests analysis, then,
yes.
Chase was 17 at the time of the motion.
Mm-hmm.
And the parties had agreed to a different schedule than the last court-approved schedule, but is there any case law that you can point us to that suggests that simply maintaining the existing schedule wouldn't be in the child's best interest? In other words, mm-hmm. it seems like the argument is that because the parties agreed to this other schedule, it's their... therefore in his best interest to continue that schedule under a modified order, but I don't see any case law really suggesting that.
No, the analysis would have to be, is this in the child's best interest to continue the schedule that the parties informally agreed to?
And so your argument is that the court's findings weren't detailed enough in that regard.
Correct. The court made zero findings in that regard. The court just sort of said kid's going to do what kid wants to do, and so therefore we're not even going to address that issue. Which I think is improper because, like I said, in Hansen versus Todenum, the court says we have to do some sort of analysis of what is in this child's best interests. And the court did no findings to that.
The motion here was filed in July of 2024.
Yeah.
In the motion, when was father seeking to modify the time from the date of the ruling going forward? Because the parties had been
Correct.
On the schedule since August of 23.
Correct, yes. The father was seeking to modify the parenting time going forward so that he could obtain the child support modification. Modifying the schedule, I don't know why you would want to modify the schedule going backwards.
Well, that goes back to what you were saying before about the retroactive
mm-hmm.
recovery of the child support.
Yeah, you can't go backwards when it comes to child support, and only during the time period that you have a motion pending.
Okay.
So
So to the extent that we agree with you and say that, yeah, that this needs to go back for additional findings, if the court finds in mm-hmm. father's favor, it would go from July 2024 until June of 2025 for the modification of the child support.
Yeah, I think August 1st, 2024 would be okay. The first day that it could be modified as of correct.
I understand. Yeah. Thank you. Was mother... under oath at the hearing? Was she ever sworn in?
She was not sworn in, and she was not under oath, which is problematic given the fact that the court used many of mother's statements to make findings in its orders. So obviously the trial court has the ability to make credibility determinations, right? But credibility determinations have to be based on actual evidence. In this case, the only evidence that was before the trial court was my client's affidavit, Mr. Good's affidavit. Ms. Good was, like I say, never sworn. She was never under oath. She was very unpleasant in her presentation to the court, and she made several statements that, again, were not under oath, not part of the record, and not statements, or not sworn statements. I cited to the...
So the one piece of the district court's order that you challenge is that petitioner has not shown that their daughter's unexcused school absences are directly related to respondent's actions. So considering only appellant's affidavit and any other evidence that was properly in the record, how did the district court err in finding that daughter's unexcused absences are, you know, that petitioner had not shown that the daughter's unexcused absences were directly related to respondent's actions? Clearly the daughter had attendance issues, but what evidence is there that those issues are directly related to respondent's actions?
So in his affidavit, there was attached a chart which documented all, you know, whose parenting time all of the absences and lates were under, as well as a confidential document, all of the attendance records were provided, including all of the little comments on there about each absence and why those absences occurred. So there was a lot of documentation regarding whose parenting time the absences were on and what they were relating to. And I see that I'm out of time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your argument and your brief. The case is submitted, and we will get a decision out within the statutory time frame. Thank you. That concludes our argument calendar of the day, so we are in recess.